Well, good evening and welcome to the Digital Finance Analytics live stream for the 17th of December 2019. Great to have you on board and welcome to all of you who've already called in. I know there are more joining all the time, so welcome to you all. I'm not going to now go through and acknowledge everybody else on the stream, otherwise we'll be here all night. But it's great that you've chosen to spend a little bit of time with us this evening. And my plan is to pretty much run the agenda as normal, although there will be a few different topics today. I've got a lot of questions already and indeed some from the stream already. So without further ado, what I'm going to do is to run the running order. So this introduction, which won't take very long, just talk about the house rules, about our models, some key slides, which will just set the context, particularly some new data that's come out today that's very important to understand. Then there'll be some questions and answers. I'm not going to be looking at the stream chat just at the moment. So if you've got questions, hold off and just wait for me to come back a little while later. And then we'll sign off. This will take maybe an hour and a half, depending on how long the questions go for. As always, there's plenty of items to discuss. Just in terms of house rules, I have to say, as I always do, this isn't financial advice. I'm not qualified to give it. I'm not able to give it. I don't know your individual circumstances. I'm talking about analysis that I've done based on my own experience, but it may not be applicable to you. You should get individual advice if you want to take things further. What I'm really trying to do is to provide an additional point of information to help you make better decisions. Please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs, please. And we are moderating this stream, so if we have any shenanigans, we will take people off. We have done that in the past. Don't need to fall into slurs. There's a lot of really good conversations and a very good community around DFA. So let's capitalize on that and capitalize on all the good ideas and not fall into bad habits, I guess. This is at the 17th of December 2019. You know, it may well be that when you're watching this in a couple of years' time, things will be very different. This is a point in time view. Things can change. But nevertheless, there are some quite worrying signs now, and we'll discuss some of those shortly. If you want to get my attention, then can you please at Walk the World to make sure that I see it? Simply because there are so many other conversations going on the live stream, and quite often it's hard for me to be able to see everything at the same time. But if you want to get my attention, that's a really good way. Super Chat should be enabled. If it is, you should be able to then ask me a question, and that should go to the top of the list. Also gives the opportunity, if you want to make a contribution to the running of the show, that's also feasible via Super Chat. Always appreciated. Now, just in terms of some background, there are always new people on the stream, so I just need to go through a couple of key slides. Many of you will already be familiar with these, but just to explain that a lot of analysis that we do is based on our core market model, and the core market model is essentially where we pull information from our surveys and from other sources. We put that information into our core market model, which is effectively the analytic engine, and that then goes out to our reports, to the various things that we do for customers, and also the things that we do on the YouTube channel as well. So that's the way it works. So it is based off data, and I think it's important because there's a lot of opinions out there, but many opinions are actually based on almost nothing, whereas what we try to do is to build information based on facts. Now, we slice and dice the data lots of different ways, for example, different segments, different geographies, different locations, and whether people have property or not. Adia, thank you very much. Really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you. So without further ado, RBA Minutes today. Very interesting minutes in one respect. It really does underscore, I think, that we're going to see further rate cuts next February. But basically, I want to highlight a couple of things. Firstly, they said growth in household disposable income has been weak over recent years, both in nominal and real terms. And, you know, I really come back to that. A lot of the issues that we're dealing with is because income is not growing. Now, we'll talk about why that is the case a bit later. But frankly, the reason that consumption is so weak is because incomes are not growing. They haven't really grown much since 2012 for many people. The other point they make is that the expectations, Eurus, thank you very much. Really appreciate that contribution. Thank you. Really appreciate it. The second point there is that they're saying that household expectations about future economic conditions have declined significantly since June, and that prolonged period of slow income growth has affected sentiment and growth in household consumption. So again, it's all linked back to wages. And this is a really important question, because ultimately the question has to become, how are we going to get wages going in the right direction? Then they said the recent recovery in the established housing market was expected to be positive for consumption growth in the period ahead. May not be now, but perhaps it will be ahead. And consistent with low mortgage interest rates and improved conditions in some housing markets, home loan commitments have been increasing. Growth in credit extended to owner-occupiers is also increasing a little in recent months. So reading between the lines, what they're saying is the levers that they've got is to try and encourage more people to borrow more, to buy houses, to effectively put more money out there to be able to basically drive it. Frankish, thank you very much. And glad you appreciate the high-quality content. We work really hard to try and get our content as good as we can make it. So thank you for that. So that's what the Reserve Bank minutes said. Now, Matthias Cormann was spinning MAIFO significantly. And this is what he said. When it comes to the most recent national accounts, we saw household disposable income, that's money in pockets, having its biggest increase in a decade. Under our government, during this period in government, they have received increases in real wages every year, 2.5% in the most recent quarter, more than 5% in the past year. Now, contrast that with what the Reserve Bank just said. And contrast that with this chart here on the left, which comes from Jericho, which shows that real household disposable income per capita has actually gone backwards, and we are right at the bottom. Inbar, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you. We're right down there, you know, below Austria, Italy, Canada. The OECD total is significantly higher. So we're right at the bottom of the pack. How come we can have both of those two apparently contradicting? And it's simply this. When Matthias Cormann's talking, he's talking about gross income, but it's growing because the number of people in work is growing. So the value, the total value of income is going up. But on a per capita basis, it's not. And on a per capita basis, most people have not seen any significant rise in income over the last 6 to 8 years. And that is the fundamental disconnect. So, you know, Cormann's spinning. He's not wrong, but he's not telling the true story. The true story is that incomes are actually significantly under pressure. And that's a big deal for economic activity and house prices and everything else. Now, the ABS also released their new data. Now, this is later than normal because they've gone through a whole new process to issue new loan flow data. But what they said was that new loan commitments rose by 2% seasonally adjusted in October, and that has risen now by a total of 15.2% since the low of the trough in May. So there has been a little increase in commitments, but it's interesting that the commitments are not uniform across all of the different categories. So for example, we're seeing that the first-time buyers are actually driving quite fast at the moment. We're seeing that investors are hardly borrowing at all, and owner-occupiers are somewhere in between. But notice this too, that the October data, this is on a three-month rolling series, it looks as though it's easing back. So effectively, it looks to me as though we've had a bit of a spurt May, June, July, perhaps August, September, but it's coming back now. So it'll be interesting to see how this runs ahead. Also, personal finance loans rose 3.1% in October, which is a significant rise previously, but I'm not sure that's good news, because I think people are actually grabbing personal loans to try and help with their finances. So I'll do a lot more analysis for a subsequent post on the new ABS data series. There's quite a lot of rich material there. Trouble at the moment is that most of that information is only 4 months old, so we'll have to wait for some series development, and I've got to rebuild my models to take account of all the new series. Okay, now let me just go on to the next one. Now, GDP, of course, The way to think about this on a per capita basis, living standards grew by just 0.2%. And the gross domestic product per hour worked, which is a measure of productivity, fell 0.2% over the quarter and 0.2% over the year. And yet, company profits were up 2.2% in the quarter and 12.7% over the year, and wage and superannuation payments grew at about half those rates. So we've got this fundamental disconnect between the corporate sector, which is actually performing reasonably well, and the household sector, which is really struggling. And that leads us to the conclusion that the household spending is very much concentrated on essentials, led by health and rents, whereas discretionary and non-essential expenditures fell, like cars and dining out and tobacco. And for example, we've seen car sales continue to fall. And just to give you a bit of a context now for this, this is the BIS data. Australia's debt to GDP ratio is 119.3. We're just behind Switzerland. New Zealand's at 94.6. Canada's at 100.8. United Kingdom is at 84. So we are highly leveraged. Households are highly leveraged in terms of the relativity between the household debt and the GDP. And the other way to look at this is the servicing ratio. This is the debt servicing. This is what proportion of income is going to service loans. And Australia is right at the top at 15.6, relative to Canada at 13.3, and the United Kingdom 8.9. And this makes the point, the simple point, but the critical point, that we have massive amounts of debt in the system. Now, if you go back to what the Reserve Bank said, which is that they're looking for the household sector and home prices to basically drive economic activity, and then you put it against these high debt ratios, you perhaps begin to realise that there is very little chance, in my view, of that coming good anytime soon. And just to make that even clearer, if you look at credit growth, this is total aggregate credit growth from the RBA, the household 12-month ended growth is at 3%. That's as low as it's ever been. And within that, investment lending is very, very low. It's actually down minus 0.2% in the last month on a 12-month rolling basis. Owner-occupied housing lending a bit stronger at 4.8. So there isn't a lot of evidence of real momentum in lending. And like I showed you, even the flow data is relatively weak. We've also got data on non-performing mortgages. Now, somebody asked beforehand, what information do we have about the loan portfolios of the major banks? And the answer is not very much information, really. We know about their 90-day delinquency rates. They report those once every few months. And we know the defaults. And we know that the defaults are going up. We also have some insights from the securitized pools, but the securitized pools are effectively selected loans, so they're not necessarily representative of the total that we've got across the whole of the loan books. And the other thing to say is that a lot of the reporting is done on an individual loan basis, which is how APRA looks at it, rather than household debt. So a lot of the information is therefore hiding, I think, some of the real pressures in terms of loan defaults and delinquencies. But anyway, APRA said in their recent discussion about keeping the zero level of countercyclical capital buffers, around one half of the rises in the national housing arrears since 2014 has risen in Western Australia. They've risen steadily since 2014 due to rising unemployment and the falling house prices. Arrears rates are also rising steadily in Queensland and South Australia. And over recent years, arrears rates have also been rising in New South Wales and Victoria, but from a low base. And that's the point, really. We may be low now, but effectively ahead, the chances are we're going to see more of this because the fundamental issues with costs rising, incomes not, even with low interest rates, is going to put pressure on many household budgets. And just to underscore that, these are the confidence metrics, the most recent ones. So business confidence from NAB there on the left is continuing to go very low. Household confidence levels dropped another 0.9%, according to the ANZ Roy Morgan, that's just come out, and consumer sentiment from the Westpac Economics Melbourne Institute is also dropping. There is a little bit of information that suggests that some may well be more interested in considering property purchases sometime next year, but that's pretty vague and only up slightly, and it's still significantly below where it was 2 or 3 years ago. So all of the matrix that we see is that essentially this is really a very significant set of issues. Confidence is very low, and that's going to translate into spending less and creating more pressure, I think. And we see that in our own analysis. So we measure household stress and we report that. There's a separate video that you can watch on that in detail. But we've got 32.5% of households in mortgage stress. In other words, they're having difficulty with cash flows on their mortgages. And that's as hard as it's ever been, more than a million households in difficulty. And our own confidence indices for all types of households, whether you've got a mortgage, whether you haven't, whether you're renting or whether you don't, all households are actually finding it very difficult. So this is a really significant and important issue that we can't just paper over and say, you know, it'll sort itself out. I don't see at the moment anything that's going to actually sort this. And that's why I think that the economy is not as strong as many would like it to be or are spruiking it to be. Another piece of information, household turnover is well down. So you can see here, this is again from APRA via CoreLogic. And you can see that the transaction throughputs, you know, it was around 100 in 2014-16, but it's now down to 75. So drop considerably. And in fact, if you go back to 2002, that was when it was even higher. And this is having a huge impact on real estates. So a lot of real estate agents are really finding it very difficult to be able to keep the the wolf from the door. The transaction volumes are very low. And the other point to make is that with those low transaction volumes, what we're seeing is less property coming onto the market to start with. So stocks are very low. The number of being sold are very low. And we'll talk a little bit in a second about auction clearance rates and whether they're realistic or not. But the fact of the matter is that volume is way down from where it was previously. And that is a very significant issue. Now, home prices. The ABS data, which we discussed in a separate post, shows that over the last quarter, you know, prices are up 3.6% in Sydney, 3.6% in Melbourne, down in Perth, down in Canberra, up in Hobart, up in Brisbane, and the weighted average up 2.4. And then, blow me, APRA took those and basically the CoreLogic data behind it, because CoreLogic feeds the ABS, and basically annualised it to give these huge rises in Sydney and Melbourne, you know, 20% or something, based on a three-month annualised. So it's a very positive view of the prices. However, there is another view, and this is the one that I think we should come back to. If you look at all the different sources, so CoreLogic is very strong on home prices. And, you know, they're saying 6.2% in Sydney over the last quarter. The SQM research, which is based on the asking prices, came out at 2.8%. The ABS said 3.6%. But Price Finder is in the domain stable, and it's based on settled sales, is down 3.1%, and in Melbourne down 4.6%. So there's something funny, and of course realestate.com.au or REA, who uses the home series, that data is also based on settlements, and that came out with a 0.8% rise in Sydney over the last quarter. So it begs the question, why have we got such diverse views as to what's happening with house prices? And I think we can pin it on three things. Firstly, there are different methodologies. So the ABS and CoreLogic has a particular set of methodologies to be able to apply the sales transactions more broadly across the market based on a whole series of algorithms. But if the flows of transactions are very low and potentially distorted into particular postcodes, it's possible that the overall changes are being overstated. We also know that the settled sales data, which is what REA and PriceFinder use, and HomeTrack, of course, is the REA's data set, that's just based on settled sales, and then they basically roll it forward. So that doesn't have the same quote-unquote sophistication with regard to the data, but it may give us a better read, because all of the people that I speak to in the industry say, yeah, there are places, there are postcodes where prices are rising quite fast, but also there are prices where there are also locations where prices are continuing to slide. So it's not as simple as just grabbing that headline view, you know, 6.2% in Sydney over the last quarter, and assuming that every property in Sydney is going up 6.2% over 3 months. That is unrealistic and untrue. So in a way, the high-level statistics that people quote all the time are actually very misleading. And yet the Reserve Bank, the ABS, other organizations, APRA, they keep quoting those numbers. So what I say to people is, as you know, get granular, go local, and then you can have a better chance of looking to see what really is going on locally. And finally, just a word on auction clearance rates. You know, there's a lot of noise there. Cookie Boy, for example, tracks each week the number of auctions that are accumulating. And then, of course, it's always a much bigger number that's reported. And so there's something funny about those. Now, I've done some analysis myself, which suggests that whilst Domain might quote, for example, for Sydney, a reported clearance rate of 78.6%, if you actually compare the total listed with the total sold, then it comes out closer to 57%. So there are some anomalies between those two sets of data. And I ran a show quite recently with Fresh Canvas. Fresh Canvas is an organization who takes the granular data by screen scraping it and analyzing it. And they also come out with clearance rates which are considerably lower than the ones that are publicly reported, and of course massively reported over the weekend. So again, we need to be a little bit cautious about clearance rates as well. And you put all that together, and the house prices may not be quite as dynamically rising. The credit flows may not be moving up as fast as some people were hoping or expecting. And auction clearances are nowhere near as bullish as some will perhaps think. So put those together and you begin to realize that maybe the situation with regard to the housing sector is not as reported. Now, just in terms of my scenarios, I drive that off the core market model. It's a series of algorithms that I've built over the years based on all the information flows that I get. And essentially, the scenarios are just a way of thinking about understanding what's going on. You know, none of them will probably be right, but at least it gives you a bit of a sort of a sense. And the reason I go for scenarios is there are too many externalities to be definitive about precisely what's going to happen to home prices. And I know people keep quoting the 40% drop, you know, which is one scenario, but there are other scenarios that are quite different too. And so we basically go through the business as usual, things going to get better, not yet doomsday, Armageddon and doomsday. Those are the standard scenarios that I use. And then we go across the various parameters. And that's the scores. Now, the reason that this looked familiar is I haven't changed anything from last month. So I ran the model again yesterday. But none of the data over the last month has fundamentally changed the basic parameters that I had previously. So there is a route to higher home prices, if in fact the Reserve Bank is right, if in fact we see unemployment beginning to slide down, if they cut the rate to, let's say, 0.5% over the next couple of years, because this is based off September 2008, before prices dropped further into 2019. So they're coming down and coming back if you follow the CoreLogic data. So we're roughly even now. So we're saying that if the Reserve Bank is right and if incomes start to lift off, then there is a route to home price growth over the next 2 to 3 years. But I only rate that 20%. It's much more likely that we're going to see small falls over that same period, and we're going to see the rates very low. We're going to see the mortgage stress higher. We're going to see unemployment higher. And there's more information coming out to suggest that retail is getting even more difficult. We're getting a lot of people also caught with regard to the employment in the construction sector. We saw some more news on that today. And, you know, quite a few big retail names are disappearing as well. So these are very critical issues, and that's why it's more likely that we're going to see unemployment rise. If that does rise, then property prices will not get up, they will actually be lower in 2 or 3 years' time from where we are now. And we can run that further. You know, if things get significantly worse, so maybe if we get something by way of a bank issue, a bank collapse, a bailout or whatever it is, we could see prices even further down. And if we had an international crisis coming over the top, so for example, if the recession that many economists in the US still think is coming does happen in 2020, that could be sufficient to create liquidity problems which would put pressure on the banks, which would make it very hard for people to be employed. And in that scenario, we have then the 30 to 45% fall. Now, the reason that's important is that will simply get us back to the long-term average of home prices to income and home prices to GDP. So that is just getting back. So think of it like a large hump coming back to a more sensible position again. So that's why it's not impossible that we're going to see that in that adverse condition. Now, of course, a year ago, before the Fed was cutting, the Fed was a year ago lifting rates, and the expectation was that those higher rates would propagate through. But now, of course, rates are being cut around the world with more QE coming. The trouble is that's not necessarily going to solve anything. It's just going to kick the can down the road. And by the way, my worst scenario, which is like Iceland, when effectively banks are just allowed to fail, I give that a very low rating. So those are sort of where we are at the moment. There is a route to higher home prices, but it's not my base case. My base case is small falls over the next 2 or 3 years, but there's also some downside risk. And I think there'll be more of a decline ahead. All right, so there you go. That's just my initial thoughts. Let me just come back to the main camera and let me start having a look at some of the questions. I'm sure there are some interesting questions. Okay, so DY says, what does it mean when LIBOR expires? Is SOFR the same? Okay. So, yeah, LIBOR is being replaced because essentially the London Interbank Offer Rate, which was effectively a capital markets rate, was proved to be essentially flawed. In fact, many banks are being sued or have been sued or settled for LIBOR manipulation. So there are now new alternatives like SOFIA, like the BBSW here in Australia, which is being replaced. The problem is you've got many contracts in the commercial world and many derivatives contracts that are still attached to LIBOR. And, you know, in a year or two, maybe even less than that now, LIBOR ceases to exist. So the question then becomes, what happens to those contracts? Do they get reshifted into some of the other benchmarks that are around the place? And how do you translate the pricing from LIBOR to SOFIA and those other ones? So that's a big deal. There's a lot of work going on around the world to try and raise the awareness of this issue and then begin to think about what needs to be done. Okay, so that's that one. Let me just pop up further up and just see what else I've got. Okay. Cookie Boys asked, do you see a leadership challenge for the PM and Treasury positions going on? What's happened in the last 11 years? No. The problem we've got is that I think at the moment those in power believe their own propaganda. And they are able to point to the GDP. And of course, the GDP is being supported by two things. It's being supported by massive infrastructure investment, huge amount. And very importantly, it's being supported by the commodity prices, which are very high. So iron ore prices are much higher than people expected. And even some of the coal prices are better than people expected. I did a post yesterday on the MIEFO. And the MIEFO basically said that the critical variables in terms of performance ahead, and by the way, whether it will get new wages growth, is really connected to wages growth. Of course, but also to do with those commodity prices. And they made the point that a $10 drop in the iron ore price translates to more than $3 billion to the bottom line. So if the price, which was $120 US, came down to 80, it's gone up to 90 now. If it goes down to 70, then potentially there's a big hole in the budget. And their forecast is that it could go down something like 55-65. So those are the sorts of things. So my argument would be that they are going to claim that it's all to do with those international things. They'll also claim the drought, which they couldn't plan for. It's already taken 0.25% off GDP. It's going to take a lot more, in my view. I think we're underestimating the impact of the drought on the economy here. And, you know, at all sorts of levels, look at it in terms of, you know, the 800 or thereabout houses already destroyed, the very, very poor quality air that a lot of people are breathing, on the health consequences of that, the fact that the farmers are actually going to be find it difficult to produce. We're going to have water issues too, I think, ahead. I'm very concerned about the, you know, not only water quality, water supply, because the forecast ahead is very bad in terms of rain. So all of those issues, essentially, those in power can basically say, well, we couldn't deal with that. So they're looking for excuses, right? But they're missing the blooming obvious that they should have perhaps given up on trying to get the surplus and understood that the economy was actually much weaker than they wanted to present it as. And so they're very selective in the data that they produce and they talk to. But what's the alternative, right? The other side of politics probably doesn't have much better track record on this at the moment. So we are in a situation where I think the political environment is quite toxic to any change. And therefore, I think these guys will continue to pedal this barrow into the future. And by the way, the main lever of growth and the thing that's stopping us falling into recession is very high migration. So we have a very large number of people coming into the country at the moment. And you could argue that we have quantitative easing through migration, because effectively you bring more people into the economy. That means you actually create more jobs. That means that essentially you can create more top line numbers. So the GDP number might get bigger. But on a per capita basis, all of that migration is actually squeezing jobs growth, squeezing wages growth, and putting more pressure on our infrastructure, our roads. And then people say, well, doesn't that mean we need to build more properties? Well, maybe, but we actually more have probably a million empty properties around the place at the moment. So according to the latest census data from the ABS, so we already have lots of properties there, and we have another 250,000 being built this year and next year, particularly high-rise properties. So there isn't a lack of supply of property, but the real issue here is this migration question. So I think there needs to be a much more transparent discussion about migration, but again, nobody wants to talk about it. And I suspect, therefore, that the pollies are going to be able to just keep this bubbling along for a bit longer. Okay, what else have we got? Have you found that property taxes and insurance premiums have increased due to the drop in tax revenue? Right, well, we know for a fact that stamp duty revenue has dropped. So in New South Wales, I think it's down $2 billion or something. True in Victoria as well. Now, they are forecasting a significant rebound. So they just recently published their latest budget expectations, and they're basically factoring in now very strong price growth and transaction growth, and therefore significant flows in terms of additional transaction flows. And also, of course, they're hoping for more applications, because every time you put a building application in, particularly if you're building a high rise, then you have to pay big bucks for that. So there is an expectation at the state level that this actually may turn around. Now, there's an interesting comment from the IMF, who recently published their report on Australia, and they said that they were worried about the situation in Australia, the risks around the housing situation. And they made the comment that maybe we should migrate away from stamp duty onto some sort of land tax, because essentially the stamp duty gets in the way of free transfers of property. Now, whether you believe it or whether you don't, that would be a very significant change, remembering that in New South Wales, you know, is it 6 or 7 or 8 billion, depending on when you look at it, of revenue from stamp duty. It's so critical. So, yeah, the other point I think we should also look at is the insurance costs are definitely rising, But a lot of those insurance costs are relating to weird things. For example, if you are a certifier and you certify buildings, your insurance premium to get cover, if you can get it, has gone up significantly, like 10 times in some cases. Some types of buildings, particularly high-rise, new high-rise with cracks and things, it's almost impossible to get insurance. Or if you can get insurance, it's massively expensive. And we're also now starting to see some areas outside of the main centres where, in fact, insurers are not prepared to insure for fire because the risk of fire is so high. So there's a lot going on in the insurance sector, and unfortunately, all of it's negative. Okay, what else have we got? Okay, this is, there's Notarii, I think it is. Doesn't RBA have its own statisticians who in their right mind would annualise a few unusual months across a whole city? Yeah, well, that number that I showed you was the APRA statistics. And there's an interesting debate there as to whether APRA has any analytic capability too. If you talk to Wilson Sly, we actually did an interview with him a few months ago. I might put a link to it. He made the point that there had been in APRA a very strong analytic capability, but basically that got thrown out the window some years ago. So they're pretty much reliant on what the banks tell them or what other people tell them. So I think that's quite a significant factor. And yeah, I have to say that when you see 3-month figures being annualized up and, you know, you make it, you know, 20, 30%, basically, it's a meaningless number, right? Because that's really not going to happen. So I have to say we have issues there. The Reserve Bank does have very smart analytics people, but if you look at some of their work, it's very myopic. So they still have this theory that debt's not important, that effectively every asset creates a liability. So effectively, the more loans you make, the more assets you create, they cancel each other out, so everything's fine. When, of course, anybody following the DFA channel will know that we argue that actually the size of the loans and the fact that there's so much debt in the system is now a real break anchor. And loans are created out of thin air and basically then go to create deposits. And so therefore, you can create as many loans as you can get people to borrow them. And that then creates more activity in the banking system, creates more activity in terms of GDP. But nevertheless, it doesn't necessarily take us to a good place. So my own view is we've got some big issues in terms of those people who are in those public offices. A lot of the analytics that's done, I think, is quite narrow. Yeah, so gold, silver, cryptos. I'm highly confident of the doomsday scenario by the end of 2021 at the latest. Yeah, you know, I've always said, and I've said if you go back over the last couple of years, I felt that 2020 was going to be a critical year in terms of seeing some of these things play out. And we know, for example, the repo situation in the US, which I'll talk about a bit later, indicates that we've got significant pressures in the banking system in the US. The question, of course, is what's creating that. And there is certainly a lot of people, there are a lot of people who are thinking that it's to do with liquidity pressures on the banking system. And a lot of it, I think, is probably leading from this source. As interest rates go lower, banks find it harder and harder to make a turn between the loans that they actually write and the deposits that they actually take. Now, I've said, and I reiterate, they start with loans and then to create deposits or take deposits, but nevertheless, the margin is quite important. As rates come down, it's harder to make sufficient margin. And as you approach zero, it's almost impossible. So what tends to happen, and the BIS did a report on this quite recently, was that when you get to this situation, banks then tend to become more speculative animals. So they tend, for example, to use derivatives and take trading positions around derivatives and essentially try and do their damnedest to create greater returns in more speculative areas. Now, if you're a bank with a retail business and a speculative commercial business, you call it investment banking, although I think that's probably insulting bankers personally, speculative business, what that means is that if they go wrong on the speculative end, then it can suck in the rest of the bank. And I have a feeling that some of the liquidity crises that we're seeing are to do with banks being very speculative. We also know that a lot of hedge funds are also being very speculative too. And we know that the total debt in the system has never been higher. We know that the total exposure in derivatives has never been higher. And what all this means is that if, in fact, we start to see the markets moving and the liquidity pressures coming back as it did more than a decade ago, that could be very significant. The second factor is, whilst there is some good news in the US economy at the moment, if you actually look at it in more detail, it really is quite myopic. There are lots of bad news there as well. And so it becomes a question as to whether they'll be able to keep the US economy going simply by cutting rates further and doing more quantitative easing, or whether, in fact, they'll hit the end of the road. And then, of course, we've got China and what's happening there with the slowdown in China and the implications of that for trade locally and internationally. So there are lots of question marks in my mind. And if you come then back to Australia, as I've shown you in some of the information, just to say, DreamZZ01, thank you, I really appreciate that. If you look at Australia, the fundamental data that I keep presenting, and it's not my data, a lot of it is actually publicly available data, says we have significant pressures on incomes, we have rising costs, dramatically rising costs, we have no contribution to GDP from businesses who are not investing, we have no contribution or low contribution from the household sector because they've stopped spending because they can't afford to spend. And therefore, we are exposed predominantly to what happens with regard to government investment, which they've said is going to be infrastructure-based, and they're doing a bit of that, and the dynamics around the commodity prices. So we're highly exposed to commodity prices, which is all about what happens internationally. The other exposure we have is our total debt. So we have more than $1 trillion of net debt, which a lot of that comes from the banking sector, and a lot of that is on 90 days. So there is a risk that if things go bad, then essentially it goes bad quite quickly. And so it's some of those cross currents that have the risk of potentially creating significant pressures on the local economy too. And my concern is that there is really no lever that is being pulled to try and turn the ship around. So effectively, we're still heading in the same direction. We're still heading towards the icebergs. And unfortunately, those in charge seem oblivious, or what other word you'd like to want to pick, I guess, unconcerned about those broader premises. They're holding out for income growth. But if you look at the predictions that they have made over the last few years on income growth and what happens, they're consistently overstating what actually happens in practice. So they're now saying 2.5% or 3% in a couple of years' time. No chance. Income growth isn't going to happen. And without income growth, then essentially all those other consequences follow. So yeah, there's a lot of risks in the system. And I think that 2020, 2021 will be very tricky years. Okay. Now let me then go back to one of the questions that I had beforehand. This is from Annie. I'll just put this back up on the screen so you can see it as well. So Annie said, as a potential first-time buyer, the new federal scheme is interesting, but what are the potential traps I need to be aware of? It's a very good question. And, you know, it's worth just going through this scheme in a bit more detail to understand a bit more about it, because the fact of the matter is that we now know some details. So it was announced last week that the National Housing and Finance Investment Corporation, the NHFIC, the new first home loan deposit scheme, the FHLDS, has been announced. And there are 27 lenders who have been approved to provide the guaranteed home loans to first-time buyers. So we know that. Of course, it was announced before the election. It was a bit of a thought bubble from Morrison. This is the first in its kind, I guess, to help eligible first home buyers purchase a home with a deposit of as little as 5%. Now, that 5% is important because essentially what it means is that the difference between, say, 5% and 80% is essentially covered by the government guarantee. So from a bank risk perspective, whilst they have to make the assessment at 95% in terms of repayments, from a risk perspective, they can use the 80%. And from a capital perspective, it's also 80%. Vincent, thank you. I appreciate that. And I'll give you an answer to the capital rules question when I finish this. So there are 27 lenders, two of the big four, and 25 non-major lenders. The two major lenders, National Australia Bank and CBA, they'll have a head start in the application process with approvals from 1 Jan. The remaining 25 will be able to submit applications from 1 February. And there's a list there of all the different banks. Now, the rates for the guaranteed loans have not yet been made available and will be probably determined on an individual basis, taking into account the individual's income, expenditure and other things. Although they have said that the rates will not be higher. Ilya, thank you very much. I think it's Ilya. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you. So they've said the rates won't be higher than those outside. So what I'm thinking is that if you are a first home buyer and you're thinking about this, it's worth tracking the rates now from some of these organisations to see the sorts of rates that they're offering now for standard first time buyer loans. That'll give you a benchmark. But I'll also make the point that where similar schemes have been used in the UK some 2 or 3, 4 years ago to bring people into the market, there were two impacts. The first was that lifted home prices in the segments where these incentives came in. And secondly, today, a lot of people have still not been able to get any capital growth, so they're still sitting on loans they can't get out of. So there are risks depending on what you think the future flows will be. And the final point to make is, Annie, that there are limits to the amount that can be borrowed, and those limits are determined by the particular geographies involved. So there's a lot of detail to get into. This is not a panacea. Only 10,000 loans will be made an offer, although my own view is it's likely to be extended later. Now let me just go back then to the new capital rules. So that Vincent's asked, what effect will the new capital rules on New Zealand banks have to Australian banks, given the high amount of debt in the system of mortgage stress? It's a good question. So basically, what's going to happen is that in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank in New Zealand has lifted the ratio, not immediately, but over time. So basically, they're saying banks in New Zealand need to hold more capital and hold it in New Zealand. There's also some stuff that was done by APRA to basically stopping banks from holding the same capital in effectively two locations, so it's separated out. Means it's going to cost. It's going to cost the banks here in Australia quite a lot. But they will have 4 or 5 years or so to be able to actually deal with it. The problem we've got is that the capital ratios in Australia are quite a lot lower than in New Zealand now. APRA is probably going to make some further adjustments in the medium term, but maybe not immediately. So the net effect of this is that those Australian banks with a footprint in New Zealand will have to put more capital over in New Zealand, which won't be then usable in the parent bank in Australia. That'll cost them here, and that will also put extra costs in the system. Is it a sensible move? It is. I think that Reserve Bank in New Zealand is reading the market much more smartly than in Australia, and the fact that they're lifting the capital ratios is dead right. But it's going to put quite a lot of pressure on the banks at a time, as you say, when mortgage stress is high and when there's a lot of debt in the system. Okay, let's go back and see. Okay, Paul asks a very interesting question. If electronic currency comes into the being, how will our big four banks compete with the likes of WeChat? Very interesting question, that, because there's a big debate going on, right? You know, there are people out there who believe that the future will be Bitcoin or something equivalent. There are others who believe that the future will be more a central bank digital currency or something like Libra, which is effectively a digital currency that's backed by a pool of assets. Now, all of those are in play at the moment, but none of them really are necessarily completely locked into the future. What I would say is that a lot of the central banks are really now upping the ante when it comes to digital currencies and are basically saying that whatever comes in, it has to be handled carefully, it has to be able to control money laundering, ID, and those sorts of things. And indeed, there are now some cryptocurrencies that have ID attached to them rather than the anonymity of Bitcoin. So it's quite likely that many of the new digital currencies will come in, will be Libra-based or equivalent, I suspect. But there are also now a lot of non-bank players who also are offering payment services. And so we're seeing a very interesting tussle, I call it a payments war, between the old players, the new players, and the digital players. And all of the reading that I've done has suggested that there is inadequate regulation around some of these new digital platforms and digital payment solutions. So there's a lot to be done, a lot at risk, a lot potentially that could lead to quite bad outcomes for consumers, because we're not necessarily always sure about how secure particular payment paths are. Final thing I'd say is, because a lot of people who think that the future is crypto, remember that crypto is based on nothing. It's based on people's opinion, you know, based on supply and demand, etc. So prices go up, prices go down. It's as fiat as money. And whilst it's digitally enabled and decentralized, there's nothing underpinning it, right? Whereas Libra, of course, is underpinned with something, right? So there's going to be an interesting tussle there. I would look for central banks to take a more leading role, because they want to control and they want to effectively make sure that the digital equivalent of future payment systems can be regulated and controlled, can be addressed in terms of money laundering, can be addressed in terms of fraud and those things. And I don't think those will be given up. So that's my own view there. Now, Michael, thanks for that. You've asked, how do you see the trade wars ending or escalating? What are the plausible scenarios and the impacts to Australia and the world? Well, it's complicated, right? So there is some sort of agreement, maybe, between the US and China, but it's only phase one. It's very limited, and it hasn't yet been finalized. There's about a month's work to do to finalize it. It could still fall apart, but it doesn't really address a lot of the fundamental issues that the US were trying to deal with. So I don't regard this as the end of the trade wars. We're probably going to see more ups and downs. Another example is the Mexico-US agreement that was sort of verbally agreed last week, then was unagreed because there were some changes that one side didn't expect, which they then had to rework. So it shows you how tentative these things. We've got now, you know, with Brexit, we've got the UK looking to do trade deals around the place. We've got China, of course, whose economy is under significant pressure because of some of the trade restrictions that have come in. So my own reading is it's unlikely that we're going to see an end to some of these trade imbalances and trade wars. I think that the chances are that we will get a phase one US agreement done, but it won't necessarily take you that far down the track. And there is a risk it could be actually imposed again later. So it's being used as a bargaining chip rather than in a strategic sense, I think. In terms of Australia, we get caught in the crossfire, of course, because as global trade slows, it means that essentially it might be harder for us to make our trade work, rather than it being fundamentally critical. There may be some opportunities too, so maybe we get a trade agreement with the UK, although it won't be a huge market relative to China. But it's very complicated. And the other question you've got to ask yourself is, all these trade agreements that we had over the last few years, did they actually do any good for us? Did we actually end up with essentially good outcomes? Or are we just paying more than we would have previously? And of course, nobody ever quite knows that. But I'm quite skeptical of some of these trade agreements in the first place, because very often they are favouring the large heavyweight player like the US, for example, relative to other players. They'll use their muscle. And I think there are examples where some of the medications that we are now using in Australia would be less expensive without the trade agreement that we have. So it's tricky. And I think there's a lot more to play out here. Now, this is from Fatman2434. Do you think we'll see the banks use mark-to-market accounting in Australia and New Zealand if there's a downturn in house prices? They don't want to. So basically, the rules are that they will only be required to mark to market if there is a material change, right? That's the wording. Material change could mean, for example, a refinancing or something like that. Otherwise, they have no need to mark to market. Now, what was interesting, they quite often did mark to market when prices rose, and then they stopped when prices started to fall. Now, they do run some scenarios, but those scenarios are pretty Mickey Mouse, frankly, and probably don't actually get into enough granularity. So, for example, we know that the Reserve Bank, when it runs its securitization models, is marking to market price changes at a very high level. So it doesn't come down to individual properties. It doesn't come down to individual types of property. We know that property prices, for example, for houses are more bullish relative to units. But quite often, those different dynamics, different postcodes are not actually included in the modelling. So a lot of the modelling that's done is very high level at the moment. Doesn't really give us a very good handle on what's really going on. And my own read of the situation is that there will be a huge resistance amongst the banks for any more detailed mark-to-market analysis, because it would make them put more capital and, of course, capital costs. Now, I made a submission quite recently to one of the committees that's looking at the question of audits in the Senate. So there's a big question as to whether the big auditing firms are actually doing the right thing by, for example, the banks. And we argued that there should be a more independent view of audits of the banks. And in fact, there's draft legislation now being taken around Parliament in parallel with this review to argue that rather than having the big audit firms audit the banks when they don't really do much, they just sort of basically, sign off whatever the bank says. An independent auditor, maybe a public auditor, will be required to go in and look in detail at two things. Firstly, the mark-to-market value of the loan portfolios and the property. And secondly, the mark-to-market values of the derivatives that the banks hold, because there's very little disclosure on both those fronts at the moment. So that will be something which will be, I think, quite important. But at the moment, no, there's not much going on there. And Timmy, I think, made the point there that China's bailed out five banks. Yes, they have. They bailed out five banks quite recently. So when a bank goes wrong, China essentially nationalizes it or restructures it in some way, and it continues. They've also in China reduced the amount of capital that many of the banks have to hold to try and support up their banking system. So not necessarily a good sign. DY asks, can you get James Rickard on the show? Well, I'll try. There's quite a few people I'm chasing. Believe me, it's quite tough sometimes to get some of those to come on. But there will be a few new guests coming on quite soon. So watch this space for that. Now, Alp has asked, how are the Aussie gold miners positioned for the next 6 to 12 months? And you reckon? I reckon they do pretty well because there's a huge demand for gold. Now, gold prices have come back, and I did predict that some time ago. But nevertheless, ultimately, the demand for gold is quite strong. There are a lot of organizations and businesses around the world and central banks around the world who are still buying up gold. Big China is, other people. And some of them are doing it because they think that the future may well be in some way linked to gold rather than actually to the US dollar. So I think we're going to see quite a lot. Aaron, thank you very much. I appreciate that. We're going to see quite a lot of pressure for more gold. But I have to say also, of course, and just I keep saying this, if you think about the amount of pure gold that's there in some form and the amount of derivatives that are actually traded against it, there is a multiple of derivatives relative to the true amount of gold that's out there. So there is a lot of manipulation of the gold price. There's a lot of trading positions taken in the gold. And therefore, the gold price itself is not a pure price. It is fundamentally manipulated by the markets. And so therefore, we need to be quite careful about, you know, the way that the gold price goes. But I think the gold miners probably do quite well. You might want to talk to Tony LeCantro. I think he keeps an eye on those. Bujit said, I'd love to see an interview with the guy from the Uniting Church. Those of you who saw that evidence, he was very rabid on the cash ban and why it should come in. Of course, I've been resisting the cash ban for quite some time. And the fact of the matter is that the cash ban is a raid on civil liberties and it won't do what it was actually designed to do. So look at some of my shows there. But yeah, it's an interesting thought. I doubt we would. But we are trying to get one or two people to come on who've given evidence to come on the show. So watch that. Matt, thank you very much. I really appreciate your contribution there. And Merry Christmas to you too. Really is appreciated. Thank you very much. Yeah, interesting. Peter says, hopefully silver will still remain piggyback to gold at the current ratio. Yeah, maybe. Silver, of course, is not under quite the same dynamic because there is less derivatives. There are some derivatives, but not so much as gold. The other thing I think it's worth saying is, of course, that gold in Australia under the 1959 Act can actually be grabbed by the government in a crisis and at what price they so choose, whereas silver's a bit less likely to be grabbed. So many people, I'm not one of them, but many people would think that silver was a better bet. As you say, interesting to see how the ratio works there. Okay. Somebody's asked the obvious question. Can you eat gold? No, you can't. And you've made precisely the right connection, right? It's okay to hold gold. But what happens if you need to convert gold into something else, right, to eat? You can't eat it, right? And that's the issue. In a crisis, you've no idea whether the gold price will go up, whether it will go down, whether you'll be able to convert it, or whether you won't. And that's really the problem with gold, right? And that's why I'm a bit more sceptical than many as seeing gold as effectively that silver bullet, that protection from all of the risks that we clear in the system. Now, Harold asks, thought of having a free market Austrian economist on for a chat. If you know the Freedom Index, the more free a country, the higher the GDP per capita. Yeah, interesting question. There's a few people I'm trying to get on, and some of them are Austrians, the Austrian school. What I would say is that there's some really interesting debates going on about the complexity of Australia's economy and how simple it is, and we're trying to do some work on that and try and get some people on to talk about that. And we're also trying to get more and different economic views, because I'm not here to preach a particular economic doctrine. I'm here to try and provide, if you like, a range of views and opinions and some ideas and some suggestions. So yeah, watch this space. You may well be surprised with some of the people that we can be getting on later on. Now, Dark Helmet asked about gold confiscation. Yeah, very interesting question about that. It's not totally clear. I'm not an expert on that. And of course, at the moment, there's an interesting debate about whether in some way is gold essentially a currency that can be transacted. If it is, could it be fall within the cash band? So there's a bunch of interesting questions there, but I can't really answer that in detail. I may have to come back separately and discuss in some more detail some of the questions around gold, I think, because there's a somebody says, I've got 22 carat gold teeth. Well done, that's an asset. Yeah, I've got a couple of those too. I suspect they're not going to be hugely valuable, to be honest. Yeah, Megan, also, you're right. Yeah, I'm not here to promote a particular solution, right? I don't think that's my role. What I'm trying to do is to provide information to help people make better decisions, or at least ask the questions that they should be asking when they go and do more detailed work and analysis elsewhere. Now, there are people out there who have a particular, you know, view. There are people who are, frankly, gold spruikers and are selling gold off the back of it. There are people who are selling cryptos and off the back of it. There are people who actually are selling other solutions. I'm not selling any solutions. My role here is an analyst and as somebody who is trying to understand what's going on. And what I'm using is my philosophical training to try and ask those hard questions, which is, so why are things the way why they are? What's driving them? What are the underlying assumptions that's actually taking us to where we get to? And what can be done about it? That's what DFA is about. And, you know, it's different to a lot of the other channels that are out there. But yeah, I may well sometimes get people on with a particular point of view who may say that gold's really good or crypto's really good or whatever. But that doesn't mean that I actually endorse that view. And I do say, and I continue to say, we don't give specific advice about solutions. What we're trying to do is a different role. It's trying to actually help people to be more informed. So at least you know some of the questions to ask. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you there that the new voice, gold is just another type of fiat currency. The value of it is arbitrary and the price fixing and manipulation is the stuff of legend. Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't say it better myself. Okay, now Adolfo has asked, what effect will QE have on the Australian housing market? Okay, so traditionally QE, which basically is, you know, creating more money for greater volumes of money, I guess, tends to lift the price of assets. So, for example, share prices tend to rise. And generally, all else being equal, other assets, including home prices, might rise higher. Now, it depends how much of QE is done. And Phil Lowe the other day said that he was more likely minded, if he wanted to do QE, to buy treasury bills rather than securitized pools. And there's only a limited amount of treasuries out there. So essentially, we might find that the amount of QE that they can do is limited. And it's also true to say that it's not universally true that home prices rise. So in Japan, for example, where they've been at QE for a long time, home prices haven't really followed. Stock markets have, but home prices haven't. So it's not necessarily definitive that home prices will rise. And it goes back to this fundamental question. If you print money, if you do QE, what you're doing is you're giving the banks more ability to lend more. If the banks then lend more and write bigger mortgages, that means that they can essentially help to inflate house prices. That's the mechanism, right? But they also have some other parameters, which is also pretty important to think about too. So it's not line of sight that we're going to see home prices go up when QE starts. In fact, it may be a signal of more pressure in the economy and therefore confidence may be fading rather than growing and you might see prices fall. So we'll have to wait and see, I think. Now, Sammy Hadid, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you. Okay, what else have we got? Thank you, Dr. Ward. I appreciate that. Message deleted for criticising the banks. I don't know what that was about. Okay. Now, let me just go on to, there's a few more questions if I've got time. What's it? 909. Yeah, just a little bit more. Okay. Here's a question. The cash ban. Is it really connected to monetary policy or are the pollies right in saying it's just tackling money laundering? This is from Lincoln. Yeah, my posts are pretty clear on this. The cash ban, as articulated, will not solve money laundering. It won't solve the problem, if it is real, of the gangs, etc., etc. That was just an excuse being used. In fact, all of the hearings showed that the Treasury and, you know, AUSTRAC have no real intent around this to, in terms of what it might do, right? So it is being used as a bit of a pretext and excuse. My fundamental view is, out of the IMF report, the cash ban is required if you want to take negative interest rates down into negative territory, because as soon as you do that, people will take cash out of the bank. So what they're trying to do is make it harder to take cash out of the bank and to use cash for big transactions. And around the world, as QE comes in, the sale of safes goes through the roof, and the amount of money extracted out of the system goes up. And we're already seeing in Australia a significant amount of cash being hoarded and taken out of the banking system. That will probably continue. And therefore, the cash ban is part of that. So, no, it's way more than the money laundering. Okay. A question from Christopher. Can you see a return to the gold standard? No, I don't think we can. You know, if you go back over history, there have been periods where effectively we've been locked into particular types of currencies as a standard. You know, I guess the US dollar is one at the moment. The question is, what is next? Mark Carney's view is the next one will be a digital currency, probably. There are other people claiming that it could be gold. Highly unlikely. I can't see how that would happen unless we go through a massive reset. Now, of course, there are people who are talking about that reset. In other words, the whole economy comes crashing down, and out of the, if you like, the ashes, we then create a currency that's based against gold. Very unlikely in my view. And I go back to the point that I made earlier on, that gold in itself is uncertain, the price is uncertain, the supply is uncertain. I think the future is more likely to be a digital currency. And if you've not heard Mark Carney's speech or seen it at Jackson Hole, that was the US conference of central bankers, it's worth listening to Mark Carney's conversation on that, because I think it's quite remarkable. Again, I'll put a link to it. I did a post on it some time ago. It's a really remarkable speech, and it probably is one of the more far-sighted ones that I've seen. Okay, what else have we got? Okay, this is from Patrick. Do you think unemployment could rise significantly in 2020 with the demise of the construction industry and related industries? Yeah, well, you know, you saw in my scenarios, I did actually ask some sort of thoughts about what this could play out to. Unemployment is likely to rise, absolutely. The question is how much. So we're at about 5.3 at the moment, but I'm watching underemployment. Underemployment is when people don't have enough hours, partly gig economy, partly because there's just not enough work, partly because it's 0 hours, all of those things come in. We're seeing a lot of that. We're also seeing a lot of construction workers now not working full-time but working 3 days a week or less. We're seeing more retail redundancies, and we're seeing financial sector now job losses as well. So there's quite a lot of job losses going on. In fact, the public sector is the biggest growth area for jobs, but that a lot of those jobs are relatively low paid, healthcare, aged care related. And so, you know, they don't necessarily generate a huge amount of income for those in those jobs. So my own view is, yes, we're likely to see a considerable rise in unemployment over the next little while. But the real number is much higher than the number quoted in the official statistics. If you're employed one day, you're not unemployed, when in fact you probably are. That's why I look at underemployment. And when I look at the Roy Morgan data, who actually does report underemployment, those numbers are much higher than the ABS ones. Okay, what else have we got? Okay, this is from DY. Do you see the breakdown of the special drawing rights? Well, there are some horrible parallels between the SDRs and, as you say, some of the fiat that's there already. The SDRs, of course, available via the BIS. I'm going to continue my post series on central banks, and I'm going to into the SDRs in more detail because it's a really interesting and critical subject area. I think you're onto something there. I haven't got time properly now to go into detail now, so I'll come back to that in a later post, I think, is the way to actually deal with that. Okay, this is one from Alf. Why can't we insist as consumers that the total number of scheduled auctions are the same from all sources, irrespective of their calculation methods? Right. Now, here's the thing, right? None of those auction mechanisms are government-backed or owned. They're all commercial operations, commercial entities. So you've got to ask yourself, what incentive has a commercial entity up its sleeve? Is it better to report higher auction clearance rates? You know, if you hear an 80% auction clearance rate, are you more likely to then bring your property to auction than if you heard a 40% clearance rate? Sure. So there is no rules and regs on the way that auction clearance rates are reported. There's no commonality necessarily between the different providers of the data. And, you know, as we've highlighted already, you know, quite often what happens is you get a whole bunch of sales that were actually earlier than the weekend. And in some cases, we know that auctions have actually been triple counted and double counted and things. So it's a big issue. I personally think the ACCC should be inquiring into the metrics around both auction clearance rates and home prices. Because at the moment, my own view is we are potentially being deceived, or if not deceived, being told partial truths, because all of the players have potentially commercial interests that could track across their honest, independent analysis of the data. That's a big call, but I think it's probably right. Hello, Merlin. You're late, but you're still on. That's good. Tulips are the new money, says somebody there. That's good, isn't it? Okay. Now, what's the time? 9:16. Okay, I'm just going to go one more. Okay. This is from Andrew. What would happen if the people en masse declared bankruptcy? Would it force bail-in and liquidity issues? And how and what could trigger the mass reset? Okay, so it's unlikely that a lot of people would declare bankruptcy, I think, because there's a whole bunch of consequences if they do that. But more likely, if we get ourselves in the situation where more people are defaulting on their mortgages, the chances are the banks won't do much about it. So if you look at the history in the US after the GFC, initially they started foreclosing quite quickly when people got into difficulty. But as the volume of foreclosures rose and the number of defaults rose, suddenly they changed. And in fact, the government then came in and changed the rules to give people more time. And today, even now, some people are still living in properties where they defaulted some years ago and haven't been foreclosed. So the reason for that is that whilst the bank can handle a few hundred properties, if there were thousands and thousands and thousands in default, they couldn't do anything about it. They couldn't sell them. They couldn't get people out. So in a way, if enough people fall over at the same time, it's the bank's problem, not the individual's problem. And then therefore, I'm not sure that declaring bankruptcy would be required. What would quite likely be a trigger would be very high unemployment, which employment could be higher, or if interest rates were to start rising. I think it's highly unlikely interest rates are going to rise anytime soon. In fact, more people are going to take rates lower, I think, rather than higher. But I do think unemployment and underemployment, as I've discussed, is probably one of the things to watch, because I'm quite concerned about what I'm seeing there in terms of some of the forward levers. So that's my perspective, Andrew, on that one. Okay, I saw some more interesting questions there. This is always the way. There's always, yes. So Major Rose says, if the CoreLogic index is used in so many public statistics, would the methodology algorithm not be discoverable with an FOI? No, because it's a private supplier. So basically, the ABS uses CoreLogic. All the other major, like APRA and the RBA, use CoreLogic, but the algorithm itself and the way it works is proprietary to CoreLogic. And whilst they provide some very high-level information on their website, it's not sufficient to be able to understand how it works. In fact, they have multiple algorithms too, which doesn't help either. So they've got this daily index and they've got the monthly ones and things like that. So, no, I think it's unlikely that we get more information. In fact, John Adams and I are looking at the moment this whole question of the home price indices, and we might well come back with another post later on that. Damien asks, are the housing price reductions in your scenarios reductions from the 2017 peak or from where prices are now? Neither. They're actually from September 2018, Damien. So that was because that's when I baselined my model last. So essentially, from 2018, we have property prices come down, hit a floor basically about May, June this year, and they've started to go up. So that's the baseline that I've chosen to use. I had to make a decision as to whether I lock it in at a point in time and then track it forward, or whether I move it each month. I decided to lock in at that point because that's when I started this particular piece of modelling, and I may update the baseline at some time. So neither of your two scenarios is precisely correct. Now, Megan says, do you think there'll be a universal wage? And is that a good or a bad idea? Yeah, well, you're starting to get into MMT, right? So there's a big debate going on about alternative strategies. And there was a conference in Adelaide quite recently on MMT that I think was very well represented, and a lot of people went there. And we know that the Treasury, by the way, has been asking for information about MMT from various sources. Now, the thing about MMT is that it says, look, don't think of government finances the same way as you think of household finances, because a government can never default, and they basically can issue as much debt as they need to, essentially because that's just because they can. So that means they can create effectively the ability to pass money out? And then, you know, how do you do that? Do you put it into investment, into infrastructure? Do you put it into investment for schools or something else? Or do you actually move it into universal wages? Now, there's quite a strong strand around the world of saying the way to solve some of our economic issues is with a universal income. And in fact, some modelling has been done to suggest that universal income would actually be a bit cheaper than some of the other mechanisms whereby what's being done is money's being given to the banking system directly. So rather than give it to the banking system, give it to end users who are more likely to spend it. And that's quite important, right? Because essentially the only way to deal with the issues of lack of momentum in the economy, in my view, is to encourage and enable households to spend more. Now, you can do it through the debt route, which is, of course, what has been done through the mortgage route. But there are other routes that could be used there. And one of the reasons that I think that the New Start is interesting, because if you were to increase New Start and put money through that route, that would almost certainly be spent. Because what tends to happen is that the people on lower incomes, if they get a bit of an increase, they'll spend it. Whereas if you do QE and those with lots of assets benefit, they're more likely to save it. So it doesn't necessarily have any economic impact. So my view is this is an important conversation to have, but there are risks. And the risks are these. I still think that debt is still debt. Whether you're a country or a government or a reserve bank, you've still got debt to deal with, because debt ultimately has to be repaid. And therefore, there are limits to how much debt, because what you'll do is you blow up the currency, you'll blow up the confidence in the economy at some point. So I don't think there's a limit. There is a limit to how much of this you can do. But, you know, it's certainly worth, I think, thinking about, because frankly, the current strategies, which are still resonating from the GFC, have not worked. We've definitely got ourselves in the situation where more QE is being done, rates are being taken lower, but nothing is being solved. We've still got the same issues as we had previously. So maybe alternative strategies need to be thought through. That might be part of the puzzle, part of the solution, but probably a small part in my view. Now, what's the time? 9:24. Okay, I'm not going to cover any more of these questions tonight. So I'm sorry that those who've asked me questions I haven't got to. There are quite a few more. And what I probably will do is a separate post subsequent. What I'm going to do is to just jump through to my coda, and then I'll just come back and have one last look at the chat. So just in terms, if you want more information about DFA and what we do, more detail about our analysis and our articles, you can always subscribe directly on the DFA blog. Pretty much every post that we do on YouTube is also in some way on the DFA blog, often with more details and links and those things. So you can subscribe there, free to subscribe. We've got quite a few people who do subscribe, so it's worth considering that. We do spend a lot of time and effort doing this stuff, and it does cost. Now, we don't do it to make money. We do it because we are passionate about these topics and we think it's really important for people to know more about what's going on. If you feel you'd like to support us, and thank you for those tonight who've used Super Chat, really appreciated that. You can also go via Patreon, and there are different levels and tiers where essentially you can get some access to additional content and also contribute on a monthly basis to what we're doing. You can also go via PayPal and make a one-off contribution. They are really appreciated. It just helps us to cover the costs of all the stuff that we do here and essentially helps to make sure that we can continue to keep the quality of what we do up. Or indeed Bitcoin, because there is basically a request that we had some time ago for a Bitcoin alternative. So there you go. You can actually go with Bitcoin as well. And there's the QR code if you're interested in doing that. It's another mechanism. Now, in terms of top hits, just briefly, there are some very important posts. There is a post about the cash ban. The cash ban, cowards can't hide the truth. That was basically talking about the Senate inquiry last week. There's another inquiry in scheduled for a hearing, I should say, scheduled for January. There's a post that I did, which was very popular, on the Fed's $365 billion repo. This repo thing is just remarkable, right? And it's QE by another name. Massive amounts. The Fed's balance sheet is being expanded. There's a post that we did on the data question. Lots of data all pointing in the same direction, and yet nobody wants to acknowledge what this means in terms of the Australian economy. So that's a data-driven piece analysis. And a lot of the stuff I do is data-driven, so that's quite important. There was a debate we had the other day about the fragility of freedom in the digital age. This is really important because around the world, we're seeing more and more control in place. We're seeing more and more focus on using digital to control populations, digital identity, payments, biometrics, all those things. This is something that we should be aware of. Vanessa, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. This is something we should be aware of because I think that we are sleepwalking into a digital future. Digital is good. It can do great things for us, but if we're not careful, we can give up so much and we give up our freedoms. Those freedoms were hard won over a long period of time. And unfortunately, if we're not careful, we could lose them again. There's a post that we did called Who's Moved the Fridge? And that's one with Robbie Barwick. We discussed the whole question of, you know, the way that banks are actually audited. And if you move the fridge out of the way, you'll find all the thing under the fridge, including maybe the cockroaches. Well, our argument is we need to do that with the banks because there are too many hidden areas with the way that the banks report derivatives. Also, even things like mark to market. And then also there's another post, which is one that John Adams and I did. We spoke about a very important event quite recently where effectively, you know, there's a particular event back in history that was a very seminal event in terms of the way that Australia developed. Worth, if you've not seen that, about the stockade, very interesting. Roxy, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. So just a few, you know, a lot of posts that we do, but those are ones that have been proved to be very popular and I think will be warrant to you watching if you've not seen them. So that's pretty much it. Let's go back to the main camera. So I'm just going to have one last quick look through the posts and just see whether there's anything else that I've missed. Harold's asked about the results of the India's cash ban. Yes. I have looked at that. Of course, they changed some of it. They're still trying to do more of it. Interestingly, there's also a story in Ireland. I saw that one of the banks in Ireland have stopped taking cash, and that's created a huge uproar. So I may well do a post on that a bit later, and we might well cover some of the other examples around the world, because I think there are some very, very important things. Are there cockroaches under that fridge? There are indeed. Yep. Okay. Well, I think we've achieved our objective, which is to cover some of the critical issues. Again, I apologize, I haven't got to all the questions, but hopefully that's been useful. I just want to do two things before I close for the year. Firstly, to say thank you for all those who've supported DFA by coming on these live streams, watching our shows, contributing, taking part. Really have appreciated it. We've had a big year. We've been able to make considerable inroads in terms of the number of subscribers and the momentum. That's been great. We've got more guests planned, even before Christmas as well as next year, so keep an eye out for that. Secondly, I want to wish you a very peaceful and happy Christmas. There will be a number of people who will be in the middle of bushfires and will have a very torrid time. We think of those people in particular, and you know, there are massive issues out there. I'm very concerned about the bushfire issues, the water issues, and the climate related issues. I think next year we're probably going to have a bit more to say about that. But anyway, our thoughts go out to those who are struggling at the moment with bushfires and those sorts of things. Keep safe. And in terms of next year, 2020 is the year to watch. I think a lot of the issues that we're seeing will come to fruition next year. I'm expecting a bumpy ride again. I think that we will see rates lower. I think we will see home prices lower. I think this bit of a bull's run will actually end if it really is, you know, as real as perhaps some would like it to be. And that's because the employment issues are still very strong there. You know, wages growth is nowhere. The broader economy is under some difficulty. And we've got the international context, which is also looking rather uncertain. But nevertheless, have a peaceful Christmas. Have an enjoyable time. And we'll be back in the new year. We'll be doing one in January, the same slot, third Tuesday of the month, despite the fact the Reserve Bank doesn't meet till February. So I look forward to seeing you then. And in the meantime, I hope you have a great evening and a wonderful Christmas. And thank you once again for spending some time with DFA tonight. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.